Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, Action SA's Herman Mashaba signals possible deal-making in Johannesburg's mayoral race. The United Nations turns 80 as Trump attacks and Africa demands a louder voice. And as SMEs face cost and revenue pressure, technology is increasingly seen as a growth driver. It's Thursday, the 25th of September. Let's start with local politics, and ahead of next year's local government election, Action SA leader Herman Mashaba has seemingly thrown himself into the fight for the city of Johannesburg. He's hinting that his party could strike a deal with the Democratic Alliance, but only under strict written terms, while warning that its past ties to the party cost it support among black voters. Mashaba is also pitching what he terms black excellence, as coalition arithmetic is suggesting the ANC might look his way to block Helen Ziller from entering City Hall. Herman Mashaba joins me on the program now. Herman, welcome. And you've reported as saying that you're open to a DA coalition in Johannesburg. I'm interested to know what might have changed since arguing those ties cost your party support. Could you be a little more specific for me?
Yes, good afternoon, Jeremy, and good afternoon to the listeners. I actually have not thrown my personal head in the ring as yet. What I've indicated is that Action SA will field its candidate for the city of Johannesburg at the appropriate time. I will only obviously make myself available if I don't find another Nasipi Moyo. You remember last year, this time in 20, when I had serious problems with the DA for 2 years, asking them to provide services to the townships. And unfortunately, with a reluctance, I was unfortunately forced to remove them and put in Dr. Nasipi Moya, who has really done an amazing work, really very proud of her. So I will only be available in the event, obviously, I don't really find another one. But I think we were really asking people of Johannesburg to give us space, because Johannesburg is in a mess. ANC has really done damage to the city. Why, Jeremy, coming to your question about the DA, as you are aware, I have personal experience. You remember in 2016, I left my business to my wife so that I can work with the DA to remove the ANC. And we fortunately managed to do that first time around. But unfortunately, Jeremy, I had a real difficulty with some members of the DA, feeling that I was putting too much effort and focus in the poor community. Something that I think for me was hurtful, was an insult, in the sense that I did not join politics to serve political parties. I joined the politics to serve society, particularly the marginalized, the poor. I live in Sandton, in Athol, across the freeway. I look at people of Alexander, I said, no, there's a reason why. I said, Herman, instead of leaving the country, to go into politics. If this ANC fraudsters can run government, I'm sure you can do it. I had no idea what a mayor does at the time. So, and let's fast forward to 2021. Action SA did so well in Tshwane, Ekurhuleni, and the city of Johannesburg. And we forced to give our vote to the DA to ensure that we blocked the ANC from coming into power. And as I said, I was disappointed in Tshwane. So therefore, I've learned something in politics. Remember, Jeremy, when I went into politics, I said, I'll never work with the ANC. But The reality in the political environment is people who make the decision are the voters.
Herman,
Unfortunately,
I
the
find it
voters.
hard, I find it hard to believe that this time around you would be prepared to consider with working with the Democratic Alliance, given the difficulties that you've experienced in the past. Is this not just naked political expediency on your part?
No, I do not say I will work exclusively with the DA. The question
I
that
didn't
you
say
are referring
exclusively, I just said work with the DA.
No, I'll work with any party where, in the event that the voters demand us, let's say you look at the numbers. For an example, City of Johannesburg, to get outright majority, you need 272 councillors. And one thing that is for sure is that no one is going to get outright majority. So what we are saying as Action SA, we want to avoid a situation where we can upfront say we will never work with the ANC or the DA. The question was that, will you work with the DA? I will work with any party with the conditions. The first one, you must declare corruption public enemy number one. We must have a written the coalition agreement that corruption will be public enemy number one. Second, we've got to commit that we are going to provide services to all the communities. We are not going to operate on the basis of only providing services to others and not only those who voted for us. These are very, very important things that I'm saying is DA, if ever for some reason we are forced to work with them or the ANC, these are the terms. Thirdly, the DA, if they would want to really work with us as Action SA, they must unconditionally commit that we will not really allow illegal foreign nationals in our city. So that's the context from which probably you had my interview, and I'm repeating to you.
You seem, Herman, to have gone a little bit further, though. If I heard that correctly, you're also demanding DA buy-in for deportations of undocumented migrants. How would that work?
Absolutely. Absolutely. If they're not really prepared to deport illegal foreigners, then they must know it. We don't really have a deal, because Action SA, it's unapologetic. We're very clear about this. But illegal foreigners must be sent back to their countries. We have 54% of our people, as I'm talking to you right now, they don't know where the next meal is coming from. I'm in the northwest, in one village where people don't really have basic services. I mean, it's really quite shocking. So when I'm saying, how would anyone expect us as South Africans, we must look at after 80 billion people of the world, when we are unable to look after our own people. For us as Action SA, this matter is not negotiable. So any party that wants our support to work with us, if they are not prepared to work to deport illegal foreigners, then please, they must not waste our time. Or that time
there's also so that's, there's also the suggestion, isn't there, that the ANC might need you to keep Helen Zille out. Are you comfortable then with being a kingmaker to stop someone rather than delivering an actual plan?
Well, something is Jeremy, we will work with any party that that would really be prepared to abide by those trade conditions. These conditions are not negotiable. We don't care who it is. We are not in politics to block anyone from contesting. We also, any South African who wants to go and contest, whether Helen Zille wants to contest Johannesburg or any other municipality, it is her right. So we will not really work with others to block anyone from really contesting.
Who would make a better mayor in your opinion, Helen Zille or Dada Morero?
None of them. But both, I have no confidence in both of them.
Why?
Because Dada Morero, you look at the state of the city. Helen Zille, let me tell you, she's responsible for the mess we're in the city of Johannesburg. When I was the mayor.
But you're prepared to work with both their parties, though, but
no,
with someone else.
Let me tell you, listen to me to tell you why. I'm saying both of them put them in the same pot. Helen Zille in 2019, when I was pursuing serious cases of fraud and corruption of ANC leaders, went to them to say, Mashaba is pursuing cases. Can you guys cases against you? Come out with a motion of no confidence. I'll get white councillors in the city of Johannesburg to support your motion. As far as I'm concerned, she's complicit of to what's
So,
happening. She
Mr.
brought
Mashaba,
back
finally then, how
the
can you
ANC back.
commit to working with the DA or the ANC, but you have rejected both their mayoral candidates?
But tell me, Jeremy, to run the city of Johannesburg. Out of the 270, for you to run the government, you need 136. So, in the event you are forced to really be in a coalition government, and coalition government is nothing unique in South Africa. That it is for that reason you look at most of the democracies in Europe and other parts of the world. They operate them are not really like each other because I'm not in politics to make friends with anyone. I'm in politics to serve my country. If I'm put in an environment where I've got to work in a coalition arrangement, I'll work with people. But there are things that I'm saying are not
All
negotiable.
right.
I've given you the three.
You have indeed. Herman
If you,
Mashaba,
as
I
long
am out of time. Thank you very much indeed. He is the leader of Action SA. And tomorrow on the program, we are slated to talk to the Democratic Alliance's Helen Zille.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at midday.
Now, as you well know, world leaders gathering in New York for the 80th session of the United Nations General Assembly. U.S. President Donald Trump using the platform to launch a familiar broadside against multilateralism, calling the United Nations bloated and ineffective. At the same time, African nations are pressing harder for more influence, arguing that without structural reform, the UN risks irrelevance. Some analysts are even asking if the institution is broken after 8 decades. So let's discuss the politics, the power plays, and the prospects. I'm joined by Sanusha Naidu from the Institute for Global Dialogue. Sanusha, first of all, Donald Trump's speech was vintage Trump, anti-globalist, populist, dismissive. What stood out for you? But perhaps more importantly, why does a speech like that on a world stage matter so much?
Good day, Jeremy. Good day to your listeners. I think the issue was really the fact that the U.S. is still seen as a powerful actor in the global system. And the fact that the U.S. hosts, or rather has, the infrastructure, the institution of the UN within its borders, makes it a speech that everybody wants to listen to in terms of what trajectory, what direction, and what kind of indication one is getting in terms of where the US is going in regards to its global footprint, but also in terms of how it sees the global architecture in terms of the support and, of course, the resources that it's willing to deliver for this international system. What we do know is that the Trump presidency has become very anti-multilateralism, very much in favor of more the America First approach, and that approach is about how it dovetails with its national interest. Immediately when Trump came into office this year in the second term of his presidency, we saw the tariff issue. We saw how that has played out. We're seeing the withdrawal of funding for the World Health Organization. We see that the funding for development assistance by the US for its own development assistance programs under USAID has become redundant. It's been completely overhauled and pulled away. So these are big, important points that give you a sense of what the thinking is within the Trump presidency with respect to the global system, but also the fact that in the speech that the president made on I think it was Tuesday, it was really about the understanding of what the next kind of direction will be in terms of the point that, you know, if the U.S. is becoming more kind of inward looking in its foreign policy, then of course it means that other actors who perhaps need to now start thinking about the relevance of stepping up in particular in terms of how they want to keep the UN system intact. And that's a key question as well.
All well and good, but I wonder whether this is echo chamber stuff or does this rhetoric resonate beyond his base, particularly in countries that are perhaps increasingly skeptical of those multilateral institutions?
Well, I think the UN General Assembly has always had this very interesting I wouldn't call it an echo chamber of how we want to consider echo chamber, but it has always been a very interesting platform, or strategic platform rather, in terms of how it becomes the echoing of what needs to be sentiment and what needs to be reformed. Now, if you look at all of the speeches that were made by heads of state at the UN General Assembly, and of course, let's also remember, Jeremy, that this is a very significant year for the UN. It's celebrating 80 years of its inception, its coming into fruition. So again, the question is, in terms of what the UN represents as an interstate body of underwriting the global architecture of interstate relations under the UN Charter, I think what you're beginning to see is that the UN General Assembly has always been that body or that platform in the UN that challenges the UN Security Council. Now, the UN Security Council is where the real power keg of the UN lies. This is the heart of the UN, where decisions that are made about whether it's peace and security, whether it's around international criminal justice, all of the bigger power decisions are made in the UN Security Council. But at the same time, the UN General Assembly can become that kind of articulation of what is not happening in the UN in terms of reform. And I think you saw this week with a number of speeches coming in, particularly in terms of what is happening in Palestine, calling out Israel for what's going on and its actions in Gaza. And of course, countries coming out and saying, well, they recognize the two-state solution, recognizing Palestinian statehood. Again, in the 1970s, this was also very important because this is where, in the UN General Assembly, the People's Republic of China got the support to become the permanent member of the UN Security Council, taking away that right from Taiwan, which was in the UN Security Council up until the PRC became the rightful or called the legitimate member of the permanent council of the Security Council. So the UN General Assembly does have that. But I think what is important here now is that issue of transformation of the UN. Is it still fit for purpose going forward?
Well, some have said that it's tired, that it is ineffective, and that it is at the risk of becoming irrelevant. Is that too harsh, or maybe just evolving to reflect the new power realities of rising multipolarity?
I think it's the latter. I think the fact of the matter is that when the UN was instituted, and remember, the UN was instituted under the Yalta Conference, which included Russia, I think Russia, USA, and of course the UK at the time. But I think the Yalta Conference at the time was representing a particular set of structural conditions in the global architecture. They just had come out of the Second World War. There was a need for a bigger, better way of dealing with states, rogue states in the international system to prevent war. The League of Nations had failed. The peace and security was not what it was supposed to be. So there was this whole Yalta Conference, but it also linked up to the Bretton Woods institutions that were formed as well. You know, your IMF, your World Bank, and so forth. Now, if we fast forward 80 years later, the world is not the same. And I think that is the real crux of the UN transformation question. Is it still representing the structural conditions that have shifted after 1989, including the two crises, financial crises that we had in the post-Cold War period? And that is the Asian crisis of 97-98, and of course, the bigger crisis of 2007-2008. The challenge the UN has is that it has to navigate this where bigger powers who have now kind of going through their existential crisis, who have set the tone for the international system, are going through their own kind of internal domestic structural constraints. If we look at what's happening in the US, what's happening in the UK, what's happening in Europe. And so the challenge is for the UN to become more representative of the changes in the structural conditions of the international system. It's a very much the structuralist approach or the structuralist argument that is being made. But the problem with the UN is you got to now think about the charter. Which aspects of the charter need to be reformed? Can you affect certain aspects of the charter? And I think there is a certain section of the UN charter. I failed to get the actual number of the charter, but it says that the UN General Assembly, in my understanding, and I stand correct on this because there are others that are better experts on this than I am, that says that the UN General Assembly can effect certain section of the UN Charter in order for there to be a debate about veto power, or not necessarily veto power, but about the reform of the UN. And if the UN is seen to be coming jaded, then they can effect this section of the Charter to have that discussion. But again, the challenge is, I think we are in such a fragmented international order. Everybody's worried about how to protect their interests first and foremost before looking at what level that you need to think about going forward.
Sanusha Naidu from the Institute for Global Dialogue, as always, thank you very much.
Top stories to keep your eyes and ears on.
This feature is made possible by iStore Business, your partner in bringing the power of Mac to South African SMEs. Now, I don't need to tell you that South Africa's SMEs are under constant daily pressure to stay competitive in a fast-changing economy. And obviously, technology has become central to productivity, collaboration, and security. But here's the rub. For many smaller firms, managing IT can be a real burden. So I want to explore how SMEs can use tech more effectively and what support is available to them. And in that respect, I'm joined by Sudesh Pillay from iStore for Business. Sudesh, a very warm welcome to you. Maybe a broad overview to start with. What, in your opinion, are the biggest technology headaches that SMEs tell you about right now?
Firstly, thanks for having me, Jeremy. I think how I'd like to boil it down is, from an SME or small business in South Africa, it's really three elements, and it's money, risk, and time. Money from a technology acquisition perspective in terms of keeping up to trend with the latest technology and how to best use technology to serve their business purpose. Risk from a security perspective. I think if you look at the recent stats, out of all cybersecurity breaches in the last 24 months, 60% have been targeted at SMEs. And really because they're seen as easy targets from a hacking and a security perspective. And then lastly, time. And time has to do with performance. It has to do with productivity. It has to do with small businesses being able to leverage technology to get the best possible outcome or result for them.
And all of that, Sudesh, is predicated on a lack sometimes of poor IT planning, which you'll tell me can hold back growth dramatically in a small business.
Yeah, I mean, most small businesses lack, number one, the resources to be able to support technology. Number two, they generally lack the technical competence, be able to understand technology, the inner workings of technology. And that's really where we try to enable them. You know, we try to offer them advice, we try to offer them consulting, we try to offer them a better place of understanding how to deploy technology to serve their business purpose needs. So if you look at it from a small business, if you're running a small restaurant, a coffee shop, well, there's a couple of technology elements that you need to cater for, be it point of sale, be it inventory management, be it how your waiters and waitresses are sort of dealing with customers on a daily basis, how they're communicating, how you're running rosters, timetables, you know, sheets for check-in, that kind of thing.
Often for many small businesses like that, though, it's a brave step they've got to take. They've got to find the courage. How difficult is it to get them over the line?
I think it's not that difficult, because what you find in small businesses is technology is being adopted. It is being used. It's just not being used in an efficient manner. It's just not being used in a secure manner. It's not being deployed correctly. So a typical example would be someone starts a small business and it's an owner-run business, and the owner decides to use his or her personal devices in the business. Now, whilst those devices might be fit for personal use, they might not be fit for business use, again, from a security perspective. So what we try to do is not sort of complicate the situation or complicate the scenario, but just try to enable them to use those devices in a more secure manner, or to deploy technology in what's fit for purpose in their business.
Sudesh, for so many smaller firms, it's about cash and cash flow. And it's critical that they need to pay attention to life cycle costs when investing in devices, platforms, or equipment. What advice do you have?
So I think life cycle management starts with acquisition. Well, how are you acquiring technology? So what we try to do is give small businesses a number of ways to acquire the technology, be it by financial agreements in terms of paying the devices off over a 12, 24, 36-month period. We give them options to rent equipment in a flexible manner, on a fixed term manner, And then we give them options to trade in old equipment, and not just the Apple equipment, but any equipment. Mm-hmm. So if you have an Android phone or if you have another tablet or laptop lying around, we actually trade that equipment in and give them value back. What we find from an Apple perspective, though, is that Apple devices carry a lot more residual value than other devices simply because they're built better and they last longer. So I like to think of them as the almost like the Porsche of the motoring world, where devices stay in use for a much longer period because of the build quality. And then SMEs are able to leverage that residual value to actually trade in and upgrade on a more regular level.
At the start of our conversation, you spoke about risk, and obviously cybersecurity is a growing concern. Are there practical steps these days that smaller firms need to prioritize? It's a given they need to embrace it, but where do you start the journey?
For SMEs, it would start with user education. I think a lot of small businesses don't spend enough time actually communicating to their staff members, communicating to their people, what are the security risks, how to sort of identify the security risks up front. And then there are very cost-effective tools that one could deploy. Never mind that, if you just look at the Apple ecosystem, the Apple ecosystem is designed to be secure. It's designed to take privacy and user information or keep it safe and keep it secure. Recent stats from Forrester, a research company globally, found that Apple devices are 50% less riskier than all other devices, simply because of how they're built and how they're put together from a hardware level and an operating system level. So just by deploying Apple devices, SMEs are a lot more secure. And then you can add on some other tools to that that are cost effective, that are actually part of our solution portfolio to further secure your business. And that's not an enterprise solution that we sort of amending or panel beating to fit small business. It's actually a solution that's been put together specifically for small business.
Your company operates obviously across a multiplicity of sectors. Are there specific sectors within the SME economy that you've noticed that are perhaps adapting faster to the technology that you're talking about, and why?
FinTech. So FinTech companies are the fastest growing segment within the small business area. There are a lot of development houses and AI development studios opening up on a daily basis, on a monthly basis. But if you amalgamate those two, that's the quickest growing space. It's this technology development space that's sort of transforming different industries. And technology has enabled smaller businesses to play on a larger playing field. So no longer are we going to large development houses or big banks or big financial services. There are actually smaller companies developing solutions for bigger financial services companies and insurance companies to deploy and to use.
Just a final one. It's difficult for SMEs to compete with each other, let alone with big corporates. How important has the collaboration dynamic become in this equation?
I think it's imperative. Mm-hmm. I think it's the number one. You know, when I always talk to SMEs, SMEs are, it's such a competitive landscape, not just from a cash flow and literal survival perspective, but we're fighting for the same customer. Small businesses are almost fighting for the same customer. So the differentiation has to be, well, how am I getting the best out of my people? How am I getting the best out of my technology to actually support my customers, to actually create a little bit of sophistication in how I do business with my customers, giving them different ways of interacting with me, different ways of communicating with me, different ways of collaborating with my employees and with my business as a whole. So having the technology and the tools available to do so is absolutely imperative.
That is critical advice for small businesses in South Africa. Sudesh Pillay from iStore for Business, thank you very much.
Thank you.
iStore Business, simplifying technology for SMEs. Discover more at istore.co.za/business.
Running a business is tough. You need tools that just work. That's why more South African businesses are switching to Mac. At iStore, we make it easy with 4,000 rands in added value when you switch. That's 3 years extended warranty and remote tech support, leaving you to focus on everything else. Switch to Mac with iStore, your expert partner. T's and C's apply. Mac at iStore. Run smooth as business should.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
And that's where we are going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.